Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to talk about the Week 4 offense at Denver. Pretty big game for Lamar Jackson. Here to talk to me about it is Josh Reed. Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken.
Josh, first of all, tell people where they can find your work and your Twitter handle.
So you can find me on Twitter at Josh Reed 907. I usually say 907, but some people actually might put the O instead of the actual zero. So Josh Reed 907 at Twitter. And then I can find all my work on BaltimoreBeatdown.com. Been there since about January. So it's been going strong and having a great time.
And you're in the great state of Alaska right now.
Yep. That's where the 907 comes from.
All right, very good. So, temperature in Anchorage these days?
So we've had some snow here and there. None of it has stuck just yet. Right now, we're probably running like the 40s right now. So right now, the temperature right now outside is 42 degrees. So it's starting to get a lot darker, a lot colder in the morning. So I got to head out 10 minutes early to start my car in the mornings now, just so that I won't have any engine problems come dead of winter.
There you go, man. Kind of a weird game in Denver. Let's get back to that. A lot of us expected the Ravens to try and run the ball. That didn't work out because a lot of the things Denver did. We'll get to that. But I think more surprising was the deactivation of Tyson Williams.
Surprising, more like infuriating, frustrating for me at least. I really don't understand, especially when it comes to I get, you know, Latavius Murray, he's like, you know, the great value version of Gus Edwards, you know, decent short yardage back. But when it comes to Devontae Freeman, I just don't understand what value he adds over Tyson. I mean, the guy cannot move laterally to save his own life or to, you know, get to the edge. I mean, Tyson has so much more upside, and to keep trotting Devontae Freeman out there, granted he doesn't get a whole lot of snaps, but like Tyson's one of the most explosive players on offense, and you deactivate him.
It was very surprising to me, and I don't think the Ravens have their entire stylistic set of backs without him. He's the only fastback they have, unless they're going to activate McCrary, which is also a possibility, but he's not a lot faster than Williams. But Williams gives you that rare blend of speed and power, and I just have to wonder if there was something in practice. Maybe there was a fumble or two this week that and came up, and Harbaugh said, you know what? We got to teach him fumbling's important.
And like, I know, you know, the fumbling will get you to John Harbaugh doghouse quicker than anything else. But like, you know, it's almost like the whole what they did with Alex Collins back in 2017. You know, he had some fumbling issues too, mm-hmm. before they fully, you know, behaved a feature back. And even then, his touches still weren't workhorse level. And it's just like, you know, like I understand, you know, there's the risk of fumble, but Tyson hasn't even lost any fumbles. I'm like, yeah, you know, Devin Duvernay was there to catch the one, you know, opportunistically, but even the other one he had, I think in like what, week one against the Raiders, was out of bounds. So he hasn't lost any fumbles. And for him to just it's one thing for him to get sporadic touches and then hard to get any in the second half of the Raiders game, but then to be deactivated altogether is just so you could say, so we want to see what we have in Le'Veon. Well, look, we already know what Le'Veon was, you know, at his last couple destinations.
Granted, 4 years ago.
Exactly, 4 years ago. Like, just because he wears 2017, I mean, just because he wears 2017 doesn't mean he's the same guy he was in 2017, okay? So I'm just like, there were so many times in that game where I'm like, you know, where Murray fails to get to the edge, can't get on the edge, where I just know if that was Tyson, he would at least got 4, 5, 6, maybe even more yards, because I know he can get to the edge and get upfield faster.
I mean, that was definitely what the Ravens were missing in this game, because the Denver stacked the middle of that line like it was 1972. You're watching that game, those linebackers, and you're ex-linebacker. You saw how close their sets were to the line of scrimmage, play after play after play. It wasn't a normal kind of nickel set. They were playing 5-2 defense with the guys just, you know, 3 yards off the ball, 2 yards off the ball. It's just absurd play after play. It's almost like they were showing a gap blitz without quite doing that.
You would have thought they were you would have thought they're playing like 7 defensive linemen or something like that, or they were playing a wing T or single wing offense the way they were stacking the box. And it's just like, you know, like not to knock on Murray, you know, but he's not the kind of guy. He kind of just like a lot of times he'll like run into the back of his blockers. He won't really like take time to find holes or do too many cutbacks. He got to the edge one time on his touchdown run, but unless he has a full head of steam, like, or has he got a clear hole to run through. I mean, the guy's going to average like 3 yards a pop. And Tyson, that's what just made me so mad. I just know Tyson would have done so much better in some of those situations where he would have found the cutback lane. He would have bounced, he would have had the speed to not just bounce it out, but to get around the edge and turn it into a positive instead of a 1 yard, 2 yard, 3 yard loss. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, about the only edge play they had that was really a good one was a short pass to Duvernay where Bell made a good block on the edge. And you know, we'll talk about some of the players individually, but I'm still really a little bit bothered by what Denver was able to do with moderate success. I mean, holding the Ravens to 23 points is still a moderate success. I think we'd agree that that's still not the kind of point total that the Ravens are going to necessarily win with. They certainly didn't win with it in week one, to put it clearly.
I mean, but if Andre Smith doesn't get called for that face mask, we're, you know, that's four more points right there. So, I mean, they definitely left some points on the board, you know, via penalty. What made me even more frustrated, it was like so like perfectly called, perfectly timed, well executed, wide open down the field. I'm like, oh, you know, there we go. You know, that was almost like the play to Marquise Brown in the Cleveland game, you know, except instead of hitting Andrews,
very similar.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, man, that was like they've been running to this side all game long just to set that play up, and then Andre Smith ruins it.
Yeah, and you really see it. Everybody's got their zone blocking scheme, their angle set properly, and he's just about it's not half a second, but he's a fraction of a second. Maybe he's two ticks too late or three ticks too late, meaning a tenth of a second coming out of his stance relative to the other lineman and not having that cadence down, which is obviously that's one of the continuity things we're seeing, and also that Andre Smith is extremely slow footed. You know, it caused him to have to. Hold the face mask. He still would have been better off just letting the pass rusher go.
And that's what I was saying.
Still completed the pass.
That's what I was saying. I was like, you didn't even have to touch the guy. You guys could have went scot free. He wasn't going to catch Lamar Jackson from the backside, and you run a touchdown pass. Yeah.
Ugly play. All the tackles in this game continue to struggle. We're going to talk about offensive line play in a little bit, but that's something that Roman had to again scheme around with extra inline players. So. We've been talking about this the last couple of weeks on the show. I don't know if you've caught either of these, but against the Chiefs, they went up to 1.82 of these extra inline players per play, where they had tight end, fullback, or sixth offensive lineman, guys who can play inline, guys who can provide an extra heavy inside the box they played with to try and help those tackles. Well, it was 1.90 against the this game against Denver, and you know that's an increase of another what? 0.08 times 8 times 70 is about almost 6, you know, over the course of the game that they increase the number of linemen they would play over that same period. It's significant, and yet against the way Denver was playing defense, it wasn't enough to try and make the normal double team power blocks that drive the Ravens offense and create their you know the holes they do on a significant portion of their run plays.
Yeah, you know what? And part of me was like, man, if they had Bradley Chubb in this game, it'd be even worse. Like, thankfully Bradley Chubb was out of this game. But yeah, it was just like you mentioned in the notes before the show, it was really a step back from both tackles. Only reason that Patrick McCarthy didn't see Von Miller exclusively on the right side is because Andre Smith came into the game and he was like, oh, I'm gonna go eat that guy's lunch real quick. So yeah, it's been an up and down, you know, with Ronnie out. I just, you know, thank God for Lamar Jackson. He's able to mask a lot of their deficiencies and turn a lot of negatives into positives.
Yeah, very, very difficult run and pass blocking situation for the Ravens. So let's turn to the offensive line right away, go through the scoring on these players. And so I'll run through my own scoring real quickly, and then Josh will talk about each player as we go. But Villanueva badly regressed from the previous game. Actually, as a matter of fact, he didn't play that well the previous week, but a lot of people think he did in his first game at left tackle. He had one penetration, one pressure, quarterback, he had a third of a sack. If he played a complete game, he'd be able to manage with a BC kind of a grade level with that, but this was over a shorter outing, and it scored out to a 0.62 as a raw score, even with an adjustment. That's a D. So he had his outing shortened. It's a really bad thing when a not good player is a very significant loss, and that's the situation we're in right now. Is Alejandro Villanueva is not a good tackle. And he's a very significant loss to the Ravens.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the dire situation we're in. You know, I keep going back to that Ben Mason pick, man. There were so many tackles, developmental tackles on the board. I'm not saying that, you know, what's the guy? The Stone Forsythe would have been like, you know, plug and play, you know, day one starter, all pro. But you can't tell me he would have been better than what they currently have on the roster right now, which is next to nothing, or, you know, washed up veterans. And like I said, at this point, instead of you know, trying Andre Smith back out there, like, you know, give Ely a shot or somebody else, like, you know, I just
Sharp maybe.
I think he got some experience starting with the Raiders and with the Washington football team. So just like I said, something's got to be better than what they have right now, because like I said, they keep trying. Like, this is not the preseason anymore. You know, we need to stop the experimenting. And if this guy clearly doesn't work, then you need to go somewhere else.
So here's the question I want you to answer me. You think about it a little bit. And by the end of the offensive line, I think you give me an answer on this, is how much draft capital should the Ravens be willing to trade to get a league average offensive tackle? So some bad team has an offensive tackle that they're probably willing to part with for a lot of draft capital. How much should the Ravens be willing to trade to plug that hole right now and give them a shot in 2021? They have a fair amount of draft capital available in next year's draft. Mm-hmm. It's good draft capital because it should be a deep draft. How much should they be willing to trade? You know, think about it in terms of like what pick. And I want a league average offensive tackle. So you're getting the probably not the 15th best left tackle, but maybe you're getting the 32nd best overall tackle in the league. And he's a guy who can play on the left side. That's my rules. And the guy is still in his first contract, and he has to have his rest of his contract except for the minimum salary accelerated to bonus, because that's the only way the Ravens can afford it. So it's a lot of, you know, the other team is making some sacrifices. The question is, how much draft capital are you willing to pay to fill that hole? Think about it until we get to the end of the offensive line. We'll talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about Ben Powers, because one of the things that really stood out to me is how Ben Powers didn't really get a chance to use his physicality in this game. There's just too much gap filling being done. Obviously, he's being jostled. Ben Powers, a guy who lives on either one-on-one blocks on like a four-man pass rush, or a guy who can make do or do very well with a double team on a defensive tackle, and then either be the guy to hold the back end of that or move up to level two. And he'd done very well on that in the first three games. He played well. This was not a good game for him. He had some pass rushing problems like everybody did, a pressure, two-thirds of a quarterback hit. Didn't have any highlights as I saw it. He lost as much, I thought, as any lineman in terms of how his physicality matches up against a swarming horde-like front that Denver showed. So he got a C in this game from me.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't give him a lower grade than that. It seemed like every time it was third and long, and the Broncos, you knew they were gonna blitz on third and long, and it seemed like his gap was always the one where they had the most immediate pressure. And I was like, golly, this guy is getting bulldozed. Like, you got to know what's coming. Like, I know you might have problems anchoring, but you got to know what's coming. Like, but maybe with the Ravens' slide protection, but there are times where I'm like, okay, like, look, you know, it's third and long. You guys are backed up. They're going to be sending the house. Either call like a draw, a quick screen, something. But you can't have Lamar hold the ball because you know he's going to get taken down. Like, the way they were caging him in from keeping him from rushing all game. Like, you know that on third and long they were going to bottle him up and either take him down or force him to throw the ball. And he held on to the ball a little bit longer than I like in a lot of instances. But like I said, you know, the pass protection wasn't going to hold up on third and long. And there was like a lull there by the offense, I think like midway through the game, where you're like, oh man, like, you know, are they going to allow the Broncos to come back? But thankfully, the Ravens defense stepped up and didn't allow it to happen. Unlike last week,
you know,
in Detroit.
This is a point you make that I think is really important, is that the Ravens are going to have to do a better job of presenting Jackson with hot reads and getting him to take those options, because Jackson is one to hold the ball a little longer because he's opportunistic in that way. The sacks are usually for very short yardage with Jackson because he's usually running forward to leave the pocket. And, you know, you're really talking about the difference between a 10 or 15 yard gain sometimes on a scramble and a 1 or 2 yard loss on a sack. And Jackson will always deem that to be worth it, setting aside the injury risk. And he's usually right in terms of the yardage, in terms of you know, waiting longer to pass, even in this game, which is very difficult sledding in terms of pressure. He did very well in terms of finding some guys on some extended plays. And so I thought those were both, you know, these are times when Jackson has advantages to gain by holding the ball. But what he needs to do is he needs to be presented with easy options as well, so that these other teams cannot rush seven the way that Denver did. And one of the things about Denver's pass rush in this game is that every additional rusher they sent provided them increased value. Other teams will see that, and they're going to see a lot more seven-man rush. Detroit and Oakland going back, almost exclusively four-man rush. And I think they might have been doing the Ravens a favor based on what we saw in this game.
Yeah, and actually, I was thinking back on this game and then watching last night's game between the Raiders and the Chargers, like even the Raiders were getting great pressure on Justin Herbert. He was just getting the ball out so fast because they had those quick reads for mm-hmm. him, whether it was the running back or, a receiver, a tight end on a little shallow cross or something like that. You know, just like having those, like I said, having those quick reads would be, you know, way more beneficial than just like, okay, hopefully someone's going to get open downfield. Oh, wait, sack. Oh, wait, you know, flush out the pocket, you know, something, you know, like a negative play or no gain at all.
Right. And to do that, they need to run more slants. They need to run more shallow crosses. And those are routes they probably run less of because of Jackson's scrambling ability. So they say, we can run four verticals, or we can run three out of four deep routes and one that's kind of a medium route. But we can run route combinations that other teams don't run because we're relying on Jackson to be the outlet receiver. Well, that's not going to work if other teams rush seven as frequently, for example, or if six as frequently as Denver did. So anyway, I'll move on, but that's something I think they really need to fix. Ben Cleveland, another guy who's unable to really get to his physicality in this split duty. And obviously when you're, you know, gaps, one of your gaps is being rushed to one side, you're having to concern yourself with not only your own block, but whether or not the other guy is your responsibility. And sometimes he is, and sometimes he isn't, you have to switch. It obviously makes it more difficult to get a nice square block and be physical, but also makes it difficult to get these double teams going. He had three missed blocks. The big obviously was the holding flag he had. Now, fortunately, that didn't stall a drive, but it still kind of ruined his score. With an adjustment, he's a D-plus at guard in this game. He's been better. So has Powers so far. I think it is largely a matter of how the Denver defense operated in this game as opposed to their play really dropping off. I think it's accentuated things about their games that are a little bit weaker.
Yeah. As far as Cleveland goes, like I think the big outside of the holding play, the big, like, you know, bugaboo for me from his game was that pull block he missed on Murray's run where he got stuffed in the backfield for like a yard or two. I was like, oh, you got to get there, you know. But then again, I feel like a faster or, you know, more, you know, back with better vision, possibly would have made that guy miss. And then Cleveland could have, you know, got the cleanup block, and then he could have, you know, popped one for five yards, or at least got back to the line of scrimmage. But it kind of, sometimes to me, it seems like, you know, the way they rotate, sometimes it's almost like they move the ball a little bit better when Cleveland's in the game. I don't know if that's just natural game flow, or like, you know, like teams feel like they maybe not be able to get as quick of a pressure against Cleveland as they would against Powers, because it just seems like Powers is like a lot more susceptible to giving up pressure on the blitz than Cleveland is at this point.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I'm looking back at the Latavius Murray play, and now I've got the visual memory of it. So Cleveland was maybe in position. Murray actually kind of disadvantaged him a little bit, or maybe it was McCary on that side, by running further to the outside than he should. But he had a cutback lane that would have possibly resulted in positive yardage. It was a second and four play, so maybe he gets plus one or plus two on that play, and then it's a more manageable third down.
Yeah,
like they made any short third downs in this game.
Oh man, are we going to talk about that later on, or
we can do it right now if you want. It was obviously a recurring problem.
Man, those are one of the instances where you're like, oh man, if only we had Gus Edwards. Oh man, if only we had Gus Edwards, because like those were the Gus Edwards money plays. Like, you know, like 2019, 2020, even 2018. Like, you know, third and short. You know, those are pretty much like gimmies, givens. Like, okay, yeah, the Ravens got down to third and short, you know, it's going to be 35. It's going to be number eight. Or, you know, in 2019 it was 21 or 30 or 35. Last year it was 27 or 35. But it was just like, man, Gus the bus. If when we had them in those instances. It was just like, you know, I've never felt so uneasy. It's been a while since I felt this uneasy about the Ravens on third and short or fourth and short.
Right.
Unless the ball's in Jackson's hands. Unless it's in Jackson's hands, then I'm like, okay, I believe Jamal Jackson can get it. But I've just seen so many times over these last few weeks where, you know, Murray's gotten the ball on third and short, you know, third and less than four or five yards, and he gets either no yards or negative yards. And it's like, oh, come on.
They need to get those run plays going outside the tackle box was the big thing for me. You got extra tight ends. You're lengthening the line of scrimmage. You got to basically set the edge by sealing it, you know, as opposed to letting the defense set the edge by sealing it to the inside the way you think of edge setting occurring. But, you know, when they stack up every defender they have or a large percentage of them on the inside, have Jackson go to the edge, beat one guy. Have, you know, Tyson go to the edge and beat one guy. Oh, wait a minute, we didn't have Tyson active. But, you know, you understand what I mean here is that, you know, he's a better choice to beat one guy there. And the other guy that we haven't talked about yet, but I don't think that the Ravens are using him in a way that is optimizing their run game, given who they have, is Duvernay. They have a speed guy. I don't see any reason they can't actually put him in the backfield. They don't use him optimally as a receiver anyway, or use more jet motion with him and get him to cross the formation. So at least the defense has to spread a little bit and defend more of the field. You get an extra guy out of the box. You do something to improve that situation.
And if you go back to last night's game, like I said, maybe we should, you know, take some pages out of Chargers playbook. They did the same thing with Darius Guyton, number 15. Put him in motion. He runs like a 4.3, 4.4. Put him in motion. Gave him the ball in a jet sweep. The guy was averaging like 5-7 yards a pop. I'm just like, God, Lee, why don't we do that more with Devin Duvernay? Like, the guy he's such a playmaker with the balls in his hands, whether it's on offense or as a returner. I know we're going to get into him a little later, but it's just like, it frustrates me. Like, man, you have this weapon, this utility guy. This guy who can pick up yards on jet sweeps, whereas, like, you know, like, I just feel like running Devin Duvernay on even an orbit motion or a jet sweep or, you know, something like that on third and short or maybe second and short, just to avoid those third and shorts is I feel like, it, to me, is a more optimal opportunity to pick up those yards than just giving it to Latavius Murray. The opposing teams know, okay, 28's in the backfield, he's just going to run it to the back of somebody and try to plow his way ahead for a couple yards. And if we get it bottled up, he doesn't get anywhere.
I mean, you know, they basically showed the Ravens exactly what they're doing. The Ravens, you know, were short the back that gave them the full spate of options to run Roman's playbook. And you don't have a speed guy other than Lamar. Lamar is obviously an integral part of everything they do, but they need one other speed guy to really threaten the edge. And that could be Duvernay, or it could be Tyson Williams, but it can't be any of the current guys sitting on the bench getting fist bumps from Harbaugh at the end of the game. By the way, don't know if you really noticed that. You got something to say about it, I'm sure. But the funny thing about that was Tom Munson to me. Did you catch that?
Uh-oh.
Okay. So end of the game, they're getting close to 100 yards, but Harbaugh goes over to everyone and he fist bumps Murray, and Murray takes it. And Murray had a pretty good game. You know, he did what he could under difficult running circumstances, so no problem there. Then he fist bump. I think Le'Veon Bell was second, and Le'Veon Bell did some things as a blocker. Then he fist bumps Freeman, who didn't do anything. You know, he might have had, you know, what, four touches or something in the whole game. And then you see Tomlinson to the right of these guys roll his eyes, and I'm like, I don't know exactly what that meant. Did it mean that, hey, look, it was the blocking that did anything in this game? It wasn't these guys. Or did he mean that, are you serious on Freeman? Or maybe it was just like, why is Harbs bothering with fist bumps on a game like this where we didn't do anything rushing-wise? Well, all of which are legitimate possibilities. But
he was probably rolling.
Impressive run game, obviously, from the Ravens.
He was probably rolling his eyes because, like, oh, we have our best backing street clothes right now. We could have had a record in the third quarter if we would have had 34 in that game. And what frustrates me so much about, you know, like, it's not even the fact that they chose to. I mean, it is the fact that they chose to active, you know, to keep Freeman on the active roster, whereas, you know, Tyson wasn't. It was like the ways in which they use Freeman. I'm just like, why are you running him on motion? He's not going to get to the edge. He's not like if you run that play with Tyson, I have confidence that he's going to get to the edge and turn up field. You do it with Wante Freeman, he's getting stuff 3 yards in the backfield, and it's just like, God, it's like the guy's trying to cut through mud sometimes, and I'm just like, why? I agree that, you know, the guy's trying to make a living and all that, but as far as, like, you know, the optimal, you know, as far as the best utilize, you know, not draft capital, but, you know, the skill sets of your backs, like, why is your best guy in street clothes? Like, I didn't understand it at all, and it's like, ugh, Devontae Freeman, man, ugh.
We got to keep going here. Bozeman stepped back from a fine start so far in 2021. The first three games, he was the Ravens' best lineman. 9 missed blocks in this one, 2 1/3 pressures. No highlight combination blocks. And by the way, the Ravens as a team, I think they might have had 2. I'm going to go back to this. Zeitler had 2 highlight combination blocks. Nobody else did. And it's really bad when you're an offensive line that lives off covering up guards in level 2. That they never are able to set up that double team at level 1 and get there to cover and cover one up. Now, they still have gaps. You know, in theory, they can pick up linemen who are getting in those gaps, but it's harder than the line is stuffed, you know, at the line of scrimmage instead of having people staggered out to create holes for the backs. It's just, it's a problem. So, I think the Denver scheme weighed very heavily on the Ravens' ability to run their most of their run schemes, but it's certainly any of their power run schemes.
Yeah, I mean, like, kudos to Denver, man. They really came into this game ready, you know, really prepared with a great game plan to stop, to at least limit the run, and they did that for the most part.
Yeah, they did. I mean, you got to credit. I assume Fangio with this is really having a game plan that was very effective against the Ravens. Don't have the greatest respect for the other stuff, but we'll get to that. Zeitler, really unimpressive offensive line play in general, but a big bounce back game for him alone. He had 3 missed blocks, 1 1/3 pressures over 70 snaps, which is pretty good at guard. 5 of 9 on pulls. His only pressure, full pressure allowed, was on a pull that he missed the block. So unfortunately, that didn't turn out to be as good. But 5 out of 9 is what happens when you lose -3 effectively on one play. The Ravens had no other strategy other than Zeitler bouncing back. And after that terrible game against Detroit, I was really concerned about is he another guy who's done on this offense? Amazingly, such a young team, you know, entering this season. Particularly on offense, and yet now it's like we're dependent on 3 old running backs, you know, some offensive linemen who are past prime, to say the least. You know, they might be okay, they might get us through, but they're past prime. Scary.
Yeah. It's either they're really young at certain positions or really old at others, and then there's this that kind of like no happy medium where you have like a nice. Like a nice, you know, adequate to replacement level performer at more than one spot, and it's just like, you know what, you know, this is, you know, this whole offense is a little patchwork right now at some key spots, but they're making it happen. 3-1 is nothing to scoff at.
Now, I'm happy they're there. I question the ability to keep doing it against teams that really understand how to game plan against these tackles, because it's a problem. Let's go to McCary. Tough game against Von Miller. It's not like this was unexpected or anything. In fact, it gave him the biggest adjustment of any lineman. 8 missed blocks, 1/3 of a pressure, 1 1/3 quarterback hits, party to 2 sacks, 1/3 plus a half. So I know PFF scored him for 2 sacks allowed. He actually allowed a portion of each of those sacks, in my opinion. You know, a false start. They did not always give him help with Miller. So he did have Miller alone on some plays, but they did give him some help, but still a fairly significant adjustment, a C- for McCary for the game, despite a fairly significant number of pressure events.
Yeah, and I attribute that false start, you know, to him just trying to trying to get ahead of this guy, you know, trying to beat Vaughn to the punch. But, yep. You know, Vaughn has one of the quickest get-offs in the league, even at age 31, 32. So even if you do false start, odds are you're not going to beat him to the punch. So I'm glad you graded him on a bit of a curve, because I said, given the circumstances and the player he's going up against, like I said, thankfully, you know, for him that Andre Smith came into the game and he was exclusively lined up on Vaughn Miller. Otherwise, I think he would have had a worse grade.
Right, I agree. I mean, to put it in specific numbers for you, his raw score was only 0.01 higher than Villanueva, but Villanueva's adjustment was lower, and so Villanueva stays a D, and he went up to a C-. So that gives you an idea of where these two are. Cologne played 2 snaps as a 6th offensive lineman. He's used the Ravens really used primarily tight ends and the fullback to make up that 1.90 per play, was the point I'm making there. A couple games ago, Cologne had 8 snaps as the 6th offensive lineman. They weren't really trying to do that much in this game. It was all additional tight ends. It was Oliver and Tomlinson and Andrews all out there together on a lot of these plays, and Ricard in for over 70% of the plays in this game.
I'd actually like to see more of Tristan Colon on the field as that extra offensive lineman, especially when you get struggling tackles. It's almost like having, you know, what it is like having, you know, sixth offensive lineman out there.
An extra lineman.
An extra lineman, you know? And I just think whatever side the dominant pass rusher is on, he needs to be, you know, shaded to that side. You know, until we get Boyle back, I feel like that, you know, just the best way to use him. Did you see him get open on that little, I think it was a little play action?
Yes.
I was hoping
so. He did have three snaps, so he only blocked on two, but I didn't count the one where he went into the pattern and the cross. And he was the first read. He's the first read on the play.
That would have been awesome. That would have been awesome.
Yeah. See, there's the problem is if it was our inside linebacker, I don't think he'd have read the quarterback in terms of saying, oh, wait a minute, he's looking at me. Does that mean I have a coverage responsibility? I think but whoever it was there, and I didn't know if it was Simmons or one of the other players, they picked up our Stearns.
Stearns had a good game. Stearns had a damn good game.
Yeah. Well, he's a good player. What are you going to do? Okay. You know, we talked about briefly the number of run failures on third and three or less. There were three more in this game. None of them even led to a fourth down opportunity. So it wasn't even a case of you gained 1 yard of three needed, and then you got a tough fourth and two decision to make or a fourth and one. And again, I keep coming back to, you need to have not only the hot read scheme because you need that, but you also Jackson needs to become more adept at changing the play at the line of scrimmage when they show what they showed with Denver. Because if other teams pick up on this and all other teams are going to watch this film, you know, they're going to realize this is an effective means to go after him. And Jackson needs to quickly adapt to this being a regular use strategy against him and come up with the ways to defeat it. Come up with Roman, obviously.
And so there were some instances where they were backed up deep in their own territory where they, like, you know, they hand it off to Murray. And I was like, God, Lamar, keep one of those one time, turn around that edge and turn up field. I mean, there were so many times where they were just completely selling out to stop Murray, where I'm like, if Lamar keeps that ball, he's nothing but green grass. He could have at least a 40-yard gain.
Yeah, he took a beating in this game. And I think it might have been part of what they were talking about in the second half was, Lamar, you need to hold the ball less. You know, I think it was in the first half that he took the big hit from behind that really should have been roughing the passer. But, I mean, he took a beating in level two on a hit as well, right? It was on a run of his.
Yeah. And it
looked like he got hit from the side.
It's really ridiculous. You know, like the way he's getting treated, he's talked about it, and it's just like the way he's getting treated, even when he's in the pocket as a passer. I mean, like it's you know, it beckons back to I forgot which referee, might've been Ed Hockley. He told Cam Newton one time, you're not old enough to get that call. He's like, he shouldn't have nothing to do with age. I'm a quarterback. Like, you know, if other quarterbacks going to get that call, just because I'm, you know, I shouldn't say big and black. Just because I'm big and black doesn't mean I shouldn't get that call, you know, or because he's more athletic than the average quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously we hate the thing, but he was last got a roughing the passer call in his favor in December of 2019. It was in the game against the Browns. Sheldon Richardson got him second to last game of 2019. Since then, in 2020 and 2021, and I didn't go to the end of 2019, there have been 162 roughing the passer calls in the NFL. There were 9 called against the Ravens, and there's only one with them as the beneficiary, and that was Robert Griffin, who drew one against Cam Hayward in the COVID game last year. By the way, Robert Griffin also drew one in week 17 of the 2019 season when Jackson was out. And it's just... it's pretty strange that the officiating, I've always hated it on defense. I mean, I think any officiating crew who calls a lot of roughing the passer penalties are very bad for the Ravens. But I also think Lamar Jackson, because he's a running quarterback, is probably not getting the benefit of some of the roughing the passer calls the pocket quarterbacks get.
Yeah, and then so I feel like what's going on behind closed doors around the league for teams that are going to play them, you know, play the Ravens, you're like, hey, the ref's going to let you get away with a little bit, so make sure he feels you, make sure he feels you every run, every time he slides down or dives down, make sure he feels you, even if it's an elbow or a shoulder, make sure he feels you. So I know that's going on around the league, and I think it's a complete and total BS that Lamar's not getting protected. And what bothers me is the hits from the pocket, especially. Like I won't say I get it, but like, okay, when he's out there running, making guys miss and all that kind of stuff, that's one thing. He's a runner. But when a guy's in the pocket and he throws the ball, 49 yards down the field to Hollywood, and he's getting hit 2-3 seconds after he's already let go of the ball, that's not somebody getting blocked into him. That's somebody legit diving at the back of his legs. Like, we're lucky that he fell the way he did and he wasn't rolled up on. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is absurd. And by the way, the NFL has no interest in Lamar Jackson getting hurt. Get it together. Officiating, get it together. Put out points of emphasis. Put out whatever rules. We saw a quick delay of game flag this last week. When the clock hits zero and it's like an immediate delay of game, as opposed to the previous week, and the Ravens maybe got the benefit of the doubt of look up, look down. That they say from the I guess mm-hmm. the Mac judge or whatever the judge is that's supposed to make that call. They had a flashy call this last week, and it was clearly a response to it. They ought to be looking at that tape and saying, look, Lamar Jackson can't get hit like that. I mean, just it's simply Lamar Jackson can't get hit like that. You can say it on all quarterbacks, and you can say, don't let this happen again. But with Lamar Jackson, I think they should be saying first quarterback hit. They're really – you need to look at every single one very closely to determine if that was actually a roughing the passer or not.
Yeah, they need to just like set like a firm precedent, especially against Lamar. Because like, look, the Ravens are playing one like five prime time games this year. If he goes down, who are you going to have for your Monday night promo? Tyler Huntley? I don't think you want that. I don't think you want that. Next week on Monday night, you got Carson Wentz and Tyler Huntley. Like, no, nobody wants to watch that. You got to protect that guy. And whoever 96, 98 is for Broncos, I hope he gets a letter in the mail saying he's been fined, because that was bull.
Yeah, he might have gotten something today with a fine. That's for certain. I'd be interested in hearing that, though. I have to look for that. Okay, so this is the big elephant in the room here, and Denver blitzed absolutely relentlessly in this game, and here's the issue with it. First of all, they blitzed 70% of the time by the average man definition of the 5+. Now, I don't really go by that, as you know. I think it's deception more than it's numbers, but in Denver's case, it was numbers more than it was deception. So 28 out of 40 times they rushed 5+. That's much higher than double what Martindale did. He was 36% for this game. And it's much higher than the league average, which is probably right around 19 or 20%. It's low. So they rushed him much more. Now, the results are more troubling in terms of why this might repeat itself. So when the opponent rushed 4, they did that 12 times, and Jackson threw for an average of 9.8 yards per pass. When they rushed 5, 15 times, he threw for an average of 8.5 yards per pass. When they rushed 6, which he did 8 times, he threw for an average of 6.1 yards per pass. And when they rushed 7, 5 times, he threw for an average of 3 yards per pass, including 1 sack. Now, that's not a big sample size in the end, but it would tell you that more was more from the defense's perspective. And I can't help but feel that Jackson is going to face heavier rushes from opponents in the coming weeks, given what we just faced. And of course, that puts a very high injury risk on him in these next few games.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And the Ravens are definitely going to have to, I wouldn't say go to the lab, go back to the lab and figure something out. But you're going to have to leave some guys behind. You may not be able to have, five, six guys, not five, six, but 4 or 5 guys out in the passing pattern. You're going to have to leave some guys behind to block. Not just your running back, but like I said, bring in Colon Castillo. Leave Tomlinson, back there as another pseudo tackle. Because you can't expose Lamar to that many hits, because they're going to bring the heat.
And I got those numbers because I think the Ravens did a pretty good job of that in this game. They used 26 set blockers, meaning those are guys who stayed in the entire time to block, and 10 chip blockers. So those are very effective, usually at getting an edge rusher to slow down as they leave the backfield. So it's on 40 plays. They used 0.9 of their eligible receivers to try and stop the rush. And it was appropriate and necessary in a game like this where they were throwing so many additional rushers in there. They're way up from where they were. They were at they're 0.65 and 0.36, but I have to look actually back at the numbers. I'm sorry, I don't have them right in front of me for these last couple of games. And, you know, they did what they had to try and keep extra blockers in. I just, you know, there's a limit to how effective it can be. And you can't run a two-man pattern every time. You can usually sacrifice one, but it's very hard to sacrifice two or three. And you really have to pick your spots on doing that.
Yeah, and for me, like, I feel like emphasis should be on, you know, third and long, because those obvious passing situations, like, even if it's like, you know, it's like say second and 15, like, you still might need to have a guy hang back, you know. This is like those obvious passing downs where, you know, it seems probably going to turn up the heat just to try to get an even, you know, further loss on the play, like, to try to get increase their chance to get a sack, because we're going to see some a lot more, like, better equipped pass rushes, you know, down the stretch. You know, like I just watching with the way the Browns defense is playing right now, I'm like, golly, I hope we got things figured out before they play Cleveland two times in 3 week span, because you know, the way that they're blocking right now, Myles Garrett, you know, he's a defensive player of the year right now, if you ask me, if I had a vote. But yeah, that guy's gonna be a headache, you know, come what's that, December, if they don't have it figured out by then.
Yeah, it's a very scary double for the Ravens, and it's in 3 weeks for them, but it's in two consecutive games for the Browns. Just obviously not a good situation. I think Browns fans are very confident right now over their ability to outclass the Ravens when that time comes. In a lot of ways, I almost feel like Baltimore really needs a 3-game lead in the division going into that pair of games. It would be really nice for that to be the case. Well, you know, it could happen, because the Ravens have a very easy schedule. Leading up to then, the Browns are not perfect in their own right, and they'll have more trouble with teams with good tackles. But it would be very nice to lead the division by 3 games going into that 3 week stretch.
Yeah, thankfully they play them later in the season. You know, like, you know, I'm not wishing anything on Jadeveon Clowney, but, you know, he has problems staying healthy. And, you know, by that time, the Ravens appear to be getting healthy. I mean, I know Alejandro Valenzuela's banged up right now, but, you know, we've heard some encouraging news about Ronnie Stanley. You know, who knows if he'll be back by then. And if he's back by then, I'm not saying all my worries are out the window, but I'd be a lot more confident in their ability to block more consistently and protect Lamar more consistently if he's in the lineup, even if he's at 70-80%. So I think by the time we first saw the schedule, like, oh man, it's horrible, why would they do that to the Ravens? But like now at this point, I'm like, oh, thank God that we don't play the Browns until, you know, the third quarter of the season, because like if we play them right now, they'd probably eat our lunch.
Yeah, I think you know, there's a lot to be said that they're probably the better football team right now. I mean, they are capable of errors. Let's go back to Lamar a second. Let's not worry about the Cleveland Browns just yet. Lamar had ample time and space on 10 of 40 dropbacks. So the 25% is low, but given the high percentage of blitzes, I actually thought it was pretty damn good that the offensive line and that the eligible receivers that were blocking were able to provide 10 3-second pockets. And when he got those, he completed 7 of 10 for 146 yards, so 14.6 yards per attempt during those on those plays. And that didn't have any sacks, obviously. Not obviously, but didn't have any sacks with ATS.
Yeah, and the announcers who were calling the game even said it. Look, Lamar has all day to throw. And when he has a nice, pristine pocket for at least, like you said, like, you know, 2 to 3 seconds, it's almost like you're like, oh, something good's about to happen right now. You give Lamar too much time, Hollywood, Mark Andrews, and those, you know, we're going to get into those guys a little later. But like, if you give Lamar, it's almost crazy how feverish you kind of get, and we're like, oh, he has time to throw. Oh yeah, he's gonna carve somebody up.
Yeah, it's a big difference too, because Lamar rolling right. Nobody likes Lamar rolling. Well, nobody likes any right-handed quarterback rolling left. But Lamar is more able to swivel his body and reset his feet because he's quicker. But even Lamar rolling right in a controlled way is just deadly. That's what he did on the Andrews touchdown pass where Smith missed the blocker, got the face mask. But
yeah. And the Sammy Watkins play that almost converted. The Sammy Watkins play that, you know, Watkins had, but then got it knocked out of his hands. He was rolling to his right on that play too.
He was rolling to his right. The differentiation I want to make there is that he was under pressure on the Watkins throw. On the other throw, he wasn't under any sort of pressure. He was just, you know, easily going to the right. Those are the defense collectively has got to be saying, oh, crap, under those circumstances or worse when that happens. That throw to Hollywood, by the way, 63 yards in the air. Did you see that?
Yeah, I thought somebody said 60 or 61. 63. Wow. Yeah, that was what you call the old Russell Wilson moon ball.
Yeah. So they usually when they look at those things, sometimes they calculate it down the hypotenuse of the triangle, which doesn't usually add very much. Even with Flacco's mile high miracle, that went 57 yards. This gives you an idea. This was 6 yards longer than the mile high miracle. So quite a monstrous throw. And obviously it's great that he could run under that. Same conditions too, you know, so you're playing in Denver.
Yep.
I guess he wasn't pressured like Flacco was, but still impressive throw for sure. I don't think we can get through a show like this without talking about record ball a little bit and Harbaugh's decision to make a run play with 3 seconds to go. I don't know where you sit on this argument, but so why don't I just leave it out there and say, did you have a problem with it?
I did not have a problem with it. I was actually worried that they were just going to, you know, do the classy thing and take a knee. But I was like, you know, a knee be damned. Like, you know how hard it is to establish that kind of record? Like, you make it seem like, you know, like, oh, yeah, we'll just rattle off another 40-something games. Like, no, that takes – like Harbaugh said, it means a lot to those players, both past and present. A lot to those coaches, you know, past and present. And I had absolutely no issue with it. You know, And I heard Mark Schlereth go on the Colin Cowherd show talking about, you know, next time, and don't get me wrong, I love Mark Schlereth, you know, like one of my idols, you know, for coming from Alaska. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, next time a guy might do a Palomalu and jump over the center and punch your quarterback in the mouth. Okay. Yeah, nobody's going to do that. It wasn't that serious, and I don't think the retaliation is going to be on the same level as a Ravens Titans kind of thing. You know, it's just one of those things. Like, look, you know, we have a chance to make history here. You know, like you said, you guys shouldn't have gave them another chance at another bite at the apple.
Yeah, I mean, if worst comes to worst, and Denver comes to the playoffs in Baltimore, and they beat the Ravens in Baltimore, and they want to go stomp all over the Ravens logo, look, that's the way it goes. The risk was understood. Okay, and I wouldn't blame them, frankly, for that. I think it would be okay, but I'll tell you this: it was effectively a kneel play. It was just a kneel plus five instead of a kneel minus one, which is the typical way to do it. Jackson, there weren't even any heavy blocks on the play. Andre Smith was the only one who even threw a decent block, and he kind of pushed someone out of bounds, but it wasn't hard or anything like that. And then Jackson went to the spot. Went right down on his butt at that point. Nobody's running for a TV. Nobody's really trying to embarrass anybody. They did take away, quote unquote, from the Broncos the fact that they had broken the streak, but it wasn't that. This wasn't a that play was not being played for blood like a normal NFL play. That was a brother-in-law play as it was run, and it was effectively a kneel play.
Yeah, I mean, like, I really don't understand. And then the funny thing is that, you know, that Fangio said in 37 years of Pro Bowl, I've never seen anything like that. And then somebody, I just retweeted it before we hopped on here. And if you go back to week 11, 2020, just last year, yeah. against the Dolphins, you know, they had 4 seconds left in the game. Drew Lock rolls to the right and throws a deep shot to Tim Patrick. He catches the ball. Why did you just take a knee there? Why didn't you just run around in the backfield a little bit and, you know, do one of those things where they kind of like a slow knee? You would take the ball and kind of – or just, you know, like – you know, like how are you going to say in 37 years of ball you've never seen that, but you did that the exact thing less than a year ago?
Right. I will say that with 4 seconds left, pretty much exactly three, four, or five seconds. Those are – that's like the range. The deep pass to one sideline is a normal response, but you almost always throw that ball very, very high and out of bounds so that the entire clock runs out. The Ravens have run that play, in fact, with Ed Reed as a receiver against the Bengals. And they had a play where they were on fourth down and they tried that exact same thing. So I understand it. It made sense. What kind of was silly about the Denver use of it is they threw the ball in bounds. There's no reason for that. I mean, I guess you can rely on Tim Patrick being a much bigger guy to make the tackle on the other side of that. But I don't really like it. So
yeah, you could have just launched it. And by the time it hit the turf, but you could have just launched it. By the time it hit the turf, the time would have extended. But no, he wanted to make that conversion. So get out of here with that, Vic Fangio.
Mm. Yeah, I think if the other option is punting though on 4th and 14, what you're really essentially setting up is Patrick to be your gunner to go one on one against this very disadvantaged return man. So if you throw the ball in bounds and he makes the catch, well, he can kneel it immediately, maybe if he thinks to do that, and you might get one play off, or he can try and make the return and then Patrick's gonna tackle him because he's an athletic guy and a big guy. So I at least I understand why they did that. I honestly do not believe that the 2020 Week 11 thing is a analogous situation to what the Ravens did. I think that is more the normal thing you should do in that situation. But I understand why a lot of people on Twitter are upset by it, because they're looking for Fangio hypocrisy. And, you know, there's other elements of Fangio hypocrisy you can point to. I think, you know, one of the things is, you want the game over? Kneel it out. Kneel it out when you're on the 10-yard line. You're already running the ball.
Just keep handing it off.
Record ball yourself. Yeah, they did already. They were running on the drive, so they were already trying to – it looked like a major consideration for them was not scoring, but to actually kill off the Ravens' record and at least take that as a Pyrrhic victory from the game. Well, they didn't get it because they didn't complete the strategy, and now they're blaming us for it. It's just – it's ridiculous. It's so stupid. Now, other comments on this? Because I got one more to make, at least prospectively, about this.
No, I mean, like Shannon Sharp says, you don't like it, stop it.
Yeah, there you go. I see. The thing the one additional thing I'll make is I don't think looking to the past for all the people that contributed to this record is the way to look at it. I think about what can this record do for my team right now? And if I'm John Harbaugh, I'd say, you know what? Our team lacks some offensive identity. But we want to make sure everybody's blocking hard. Everybody's doing their job. I want to make sure I can tell every one of these players, playing like a Raven means you're a receiver, you block. It means if you're a running back and somebody else like Lamar is running the ball, you block. You know, if you're a tight end, you better not be caught without a dance partner in level two kind of thing. I want to be able to say those things to my players. And so I one of the things I can do is I can demonstrate that this record is important. I can keep it going, and I can keep even defensive players like Marlon Humphrey holding my offense accountable by saying, you know, I was looking at the rushing yards the whole game. I was really hoping they'd run the ball again. Well, good. I'm glad. That's team unity right there in force. If you want to look at this as a going forward item, that's terrific value for that, to maintain this facet of their identity that they jealously guard. So it's the same reason why the 72 Dolphins are still popping champagne corks when the last team goes defeated, is that they jealously guard, and that and it's still a unifying factor for that group of old men now.
Yeah, I mean, just to be a part of history, like it just means so much. Like, you know, like even me on a smaller scale, the fact that I was a state champion my last year in high school, it means something to me. You know, I'm not one of those guys that live in the past and go around parading your state championship ring. But you know, like whenever I'm out on an assignment for the paper up here, and somebody asks, like, "Oh, did you go to school up here?" I'm like, "Yeah, I went to West." "Oh, what year did you go to West?" "Oh, I went 24th." "Oh, did you all win state?" "Yeah, I was on that team." Yeah, you know, you know, it's just like a sense of pride that you. Except even guys who weren't necessarily part of, you know, like, you know, the record breaking, you know, game or whatever, that even those guys can take pride in it. So I know Miles Boykin takes pride in it. He'd be blocking his ass off.
Yeah, you're right. And Miles Boykin would, you know, I really want him back, by the way. I mean, Miles Boykin can provide a lot to this team if they want to reestablish a run identity. And you know what else? He'll take the top off some defenses, too. As much as he's had problems, he's an extra speed weapon for the Ravens to use on some deep throws.
Yeah.
All right. We talked about record ball. Other skill position players, who would you like to talk about?
Marquise Brown, man. Like, that guy, I even tweeted out, you know, like, you know, he really redeemed himself on that play. He let us all know after he scored a touchdown. You see the little celebration he did with his hands? Like the ball's like the ball's in there. So, I mean, after that rough game he had last week, to come back and you know, not just, you know, catch a, you know, little slant and go and turn up field, but to actually, you know, make a similar play. Like, you know, lay out for that ball, go out, you know, blow past the defense, another deep ball to track it the way he did, and then lay out the way he did to catch the ball. I mean, what a redemption song.
Yeah, it was certainly a great grab. And the fact that he's able to put that subtle double move on, I think it was Simmons was the defender, the safety deep on that side of the field. He got Simmons to turn to the outside, you know, the right side of that field, and then he moved inside and he was gone. There wasn't anybody to cover him at all. It was a deep cover too, you know, so presumably you have some defense against those sorts of routes, but Simmons' wrong turn there really put it in, made it a fairly easy pitch and catch that got made into a more difficult pitch and catch by an absolute cannon shot from Lamar.
Oh, yeah. It was whistling through that thin Denver air. I mean, Simmons got picked on a little bit in this game by both Marquise and Mark Andrews.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, Simmons' value is in a short zone. You know, he's when he's up and playing a dime back kind of role, or he's a he gets in position where his responsibility is a short zone. He's deadly because he can come downhill, take out a running back. He can do all sorts of good things for you. But he's more useful in that dime back role than he is anywhere where he's out in space in coverage. Obviously, and that's true of a lot of safeties. It's not real surprising, particularly strong safeties.
Yeah, he made a nice play at Josh Oliver, but that was about it. Other than that, he was getting mossed by Mark Andrews a lot.
Andrews, yeah. James Prochet, a guy I want to talk about. I thought he did a lot to build the connection with Lamar in this game. Obviously, a big trust-building game, and nothing builds trust like being there after an extended pocket happens. If you're there after an extended pocket for Lamar, I guarantee you, you're going to get more looks. And Prochet came across the field several times to that right boundary, and all but one time I didn't think he really took the right angle to come back to Lamar more. But all the other times he took the right angle to be right where that ball needed to be for Lamar to get it off in good order and for him to make the catch in bounds.
And honestly, I think that trust thing started back last week when he hit that 29-yarder against Detroit on the right side of the field. You know, he's the kind of guy that on those scramble plays, and you know, he makes himself available, has that great spatial awareness and body control to keep his feet in bounds and present himself as a viable target for Lamar. And you know, just him making that catch last week and then translate to this week, you can really see that he's really starting to earn the trust of Lamar Jackson in some key situations too. I mean, like there are a bunch of times where he caught those balls, like I think four of his five balls resulted in first downs. A couple times he was short of the sticks and just lowered his head and moved the chains.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, he did have a really good turn and get those extra 2 yards to get the first down on one play, and then they got locked up with each other, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, but it looked like actually Prochet had his hand on his jersey or something up near his neck. So it was like they both took a while to release. I couldn't tell exactly what was going on there initially. One thing about this game that shows up is that when the other team is rushing five, six, seven guys, you're going to have really good opportunities on extended plays. That's obvious and normal, but even the more difficult pressured extended plays where Lamar is actually being chased to the right sideline, there's nobody else there in that short zone. And the guy, the cornerback behind the receiver who's going to the boundary, generally speaking, can't make a play on the ball other than to wait and let that ball be caught. So it better be a case where that receiver, he has an important job in this kind of a game where Lamar's getting chased around a little bit, to come back and get that football. And Prochet really came through, I thought, in this. A very good game for him.
Yeah, he made some good adjustments to some low.
Who would you like to talk about?
Oh, I was good. So one more thing on Prochet. He made some good adjustments on some low thrown balls too, where he kind of got it before it hit the ground, and he had that one where he caught it and hit the ground and nobody touched him, and then he kind of just let the ball hang out there, and then Keith Williams or T. Martin talked to him on the sideline about, hey, you got to tuck the thing away, man, or get up and run. But other than that, I thought it was a great day by Prochet.
Your turn, though. Who would you like to bring up next?
Mark Andrews. Mark Andrews has been heating up these past couple of weeks. And, like a lot of it's the beneficiary of, a lot of teams playing more zone against the Ravens to try to, mitigate what Lamar does as a runner. But that leaves a lot of space open for Mark Andrews to work. I like to see less sliding grabs by him just because I want to see him get hit in stride so he can, turn up field, use some of that, some of that yak ability. But, yeah, the guy just, he just gets open and, the way that he gets open at, that second level of the field where it's like, oh, that's a chunk play to Mark Andrews, and the way he gets on top of safeties like Justin Simmons and some of those other highly regarded safeties, it's a thing of beauty. He's improved greatly as a blocker as well. It really pains me that he didn't get that touchdown. It would have been his first of the season, but I expect a lot more big things from Mark Andrews to come.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be a problem if him getting some big plays down the stretch here, because he's still the most connected receiver to Lamar by far, even more than Hollywood. Hollywood, he's had a good connection with this year, but Andrews is just always the first read. And if they're during camp, boy, I mean, it was almost like, can you throw it to somebody else? Can you try and develop another connection? And he's done a little bit with Watkins, but Andrews is still his go-to guy. And I'm agreeing with you that I think the level two, level three opportunities for Andrews, particularly if other teams are going to maintain some of this high blitz rate, are where the money really is. Mm-hmm. It's harder for him to run a shallow cross. I think we saw that on Simmons, at least one or two, perhaps two plays, where Simmons made a play on a ball that was intended for Andrews on a cross, and was able to get in there and get his hand up. One of them might have been Watkins, so I might be wrong about that. But there were a couple of plays that were more shallow that, you know, it's like, why isn't Andrews trying to threaten level two, level three on these plays?
Yeah, I just love him as a down the field target, more so than just a short intermediate level target.
All right, I'll talk about Tomlinson a little bit. He's had a terrific year right now blocking for the Ravens. It's actually hard for me to think back to roster cutdown day and the risk that, I mean, they had a pre-made agreement, obviously, they were going to bring him back, but to cut him and then bring him back and even be a little bit slow about it, because didn't Tomlinson and Levine, they waited an extra week, or maybe I have it wrong, maybe it was Tomlinson or Levine and another player.
I think it was McPhee who signed back last.
McPhee, okay, I may not be right, but I thought Tomlinson was on the first week roster, and I guess Levine might have not been on the roster till week two and was a practice squad call up in week one. But anyway, the point I'm making is that Tomlinson has really paid off for the Ravens this year. And there were questions about whether or not he was good enough to be the fourth tight end, beat out Oliver. I mean, he is so integral to the Ravens offense relative to what Josh Oliver does for this team. It's not even funny.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of hype around Josh Oliver, you know, preseason and all that, and offseason, it's the third pass-catching tight end, and, you know, oh, the Hayden Hurst 2.0 or, you know, 1.5, but I just think what Tomlinson brings right now, especially with considering the tackle situation, is on a much greater level, especially with all the, if the receivers weren't producing at the level that they were producing right now, I'd be, you know, oh, man, we need Josh Oliver to step up, but the fact that you're getting more production from the receiver position kind of mitigates that, oh, we need a third pass catching tight end kind of thing. So that's why I value what Tomlinson is bringing to the table more so than Josh Oliver.
All right, your turn. Anybody else you want to talk about?
Devin Duvernay. I'll talk about Devin Duvernay. He's a guy that, like I said earlier, whenever he gets the ball in his hands, you know, he's a threat to make. He's like a spark plug. You know, big play waiting to happen. Now, he made some questionable calls on as far as fielding punts. Like the one he let go to the 4-yard line and to the 11-yard line. But like he always he's going to make up for it eventually. And then he had that 42-yard, return to set up, you know, the Ravens in scoring position just before halftime. And then also as a receiver, I mean, that guy's average depth of target is only like 5.7 yards per target, average depth of target, but he averaged 10 yards a catch in this game because, you know, he has that yard after catch ability. You know, he has that ability to, you know, not just catch the ball and you get you those, you know, 5 yards, you know, where you're hitting them, but also turn up field and get some more yards. So, you know, he didn't finish with a gaudy day. He just, like, he had 3 catches for 31 yards. But the fact that, you know, the guy's a threat, you know, his all-purpose, you should always look at his all-purpose yards at the end of each game. And he's always going to be in at least almost to 100, if not over 100, you know, if you throw in his receiving and his returning. And even, you know, his rushing, if they would use him in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, I like what Duvernay brings to the offense. I really wish they would use him more as a run threat or maybe as a screen threat. You know, they targeted him 6 times in this game for 31 yards. I'm not saying his yak isn't good, because it is. He made a really nice play on 2nd and 20, I think, when Bell gave him that block along the edge, the way the flag got picked up. But it's also 6 targets for 31 yards. And at 5.2 yards per target, I'm really unexcited about that from a wide receiver. So he's either got to be a deeper threat down the field, which I'm not sure that he's the perfect guy for that. I think a lot of corners can keep up with his kind of speed. I think the way he can help you more is by being that jet motion, orbit motion back who threatens the edge and threatens it with run or pass to get you speed to the edge that causes the defense to loosen up and spread out a little bit.
Yeah, he did get behind the defense that one time. Lamar missed him deep down the left sideline. But I'm in agreement with you as far as like being not having that take top of a defense speed, but you know that kind of breakaway speed.
Mm-hmm. All right, MVPs. Do you want to talk MVPs in this game? Then we're going to go to the mailbag. What do you say?
Oh, sure, sounds good.
Who's your number 3 guy in this game?
Number three, probably be Prochet. Like I said, your list and my list is pretty much spot on. I throw Mark Andrews in there too, just because I liked what I saw from him. But I just think the way that Prochet kind of has, you know, his coming out party, you know, on Sunday, and really what was more meaningful, the fact that the production was how he got it, you know, as far as getting open, you know, being that reliable outlet guy, picking up those first downs, like, you know, whenever you can not just, you know, catch a ball and, you know, on you know, second, first and 20 for, you know, for 10 yards, you know, that doesn't move a needle for me. But the fact that you catch it, you know, short of the sticks and then get beyond the sticks, whether it's, you know, before you catch the ball or, you know, as a run after the catch opportunity, I really like what I saw from him. And I'm curious to see what his role is going to look like. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You did a lot of things right in this game in terms of being in the right place, in terms of getting yards after the catch. It was a lot. It was a big trust game for Prochet. He's my number two guy on the MVP list. My number three guy was Hollywood. I thought that, you know, I could understand putting Andrews in the spot or Andrews in the two spot, whatever you might have done. But to me, Hollywood's ability to stretch the defense is what's going to be really important to the Ravens, and they need him back catching the football, and that he did in this game. So he had a So like, what did he end up into in terms of catches for
I think like four, like, five, I think four, for yeah, 91. Yeah, four for 91, yeah.
Yeah, but on only five targets is the point. Is he didn't have a lot of wasted targets in this game, whereas Duvernay kind of had three wasted targets as this went. Okay, you had Andrews at number two, I take it then.
No, so I had Andrews as two. Like I said, it was kind of like a tie between Andrews and Marquise for me for number two. I mean, for number three, because I had Prochet as my number two. Just because, like for the reasons I explained. But I think we're in agreement as far as who number one is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't think we have to talk about that too much. Great game for Lamar in terms of accuracy. I thought he really threw balls that I don't remember seeing that kind of tight spiral, that kind of high spin rate that we saw or even in 18 or even in 19. So I really love the way he's throwing the football this year. The only a couple of passes early, he kind of short armed them.
Yeah,
like, it almost looked like a Denver adjustment he was making. Did it seem like that to you?
Yeah, that was like, oh, you gotta stop throwing those in the dirt, man. Because like he threw it like right at the receiver's feet, where I'm like, you know, you raise that ball up 3-4 feet, and that's a catch. You know, and you're looking at second and four instead of third and long, or whatever.
All right. How about we go to the mailbag here and we'll talk through some questions. Got a fair number of good ones always in the list. Okay. So one of them is interesting. This is from Chip Rose. He asks, what tackle options exist with Villanueva's injury? So I guess we're going to go into the assumption that Villanueva is hurt this week. What do you think the Ravens do at offensive tackle in terms of activations? The only guy they have on the roster currently who plays tackle, at least it that they will admit plays tackle, is McCary.
Yeah, they definitely have to come from a practice squad elevation. I don't think you're going to bring a guy off the street to start right left tackle on Monday Night Football, less than a week from now. So I think it either have to be McCary or, like I said, Sharp has some experience on the practice squad. I'd like to see Ely activated, you know, even if it's just in a backup role. I just really don't want to see Andre Smith out there at left tackle. I mean, I know the Colts don't really have anybody to write home about as far as, you know, edge rushers, but anybody will look good against Andre Smith. So I'd rather not have him out there.
Yeah, big problem. And you make a good point about they really can't bring anybody else to have them play tackle next week. So it has to be two of the three guys on the practice squad. So they have four now. No, they have Andre Smith, David Sharp, No, they have Jared Jones Smith. Forgot about him. So he's the 6'7", 320 guy from Pittsburgh. And they have Ely as well. So they do have four tackles on the practice squad, but two of those will have to be elevated this next week. And they've been using their COVID activations to elevate Andre Smith so far. So they haven't used any practice squad elevations for him yet. So I believe for any of those tackles, it would be still the first for them to be elevated.
Yeah, if you were to ask me, just based on, like I said,
another question from this list.
I was just going to make one more comment. If you were to ask me as far as like of the tackles on the practice squad, I'd leave Andre Smith down and bring up Ely and Sharp just because, like, I'm good on Andre.
Yeah, Let me explain to something to folks. So this is a production issue we're trying to get through here, but we have a little bit of a sound delay between Josh and me. And so it sounds like I'm interrupting him before he responds to me, but it seems like he doesn't have anything to say because it's taking a third of a second or something to get to Alaska. And so I'm moving on. We'll be more careful about that. I'm sorry for the appearance of this, Josh, but really want to respect your opportunity and what you have to say about these players. Do you want to take the next question?
Oh, sure. Read it off. I don't have it in front of me right now.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. Nick asks, we as fans realistically expect Bateman back this week, with Prochet also having return man abilities. Could he give the O better field position at times where Duvernay hasn't? And I know you spoke highly of Duvernay in terms of your comments about him.
So they're asking if Bateman would fill some of those duties.
I didn't really set this question. I think they're saying Bateman would take Prochet's spot as a receiver, and Prochet would take Duvernay's spot as a returner.
No, so I think they like Duvernay as a returner too much to have him deactivated, and the fact that he can do more things on offense. Not saying that Prochet can't, but like I said, as frustrating as Duvernay can be at times, as far as, you know, judgment calls, fielding punts, he's too much of a big play threat to leave on an inactive list. So I think it's going to be really like I was saying earlier, it might I'm really curious to see what Prochet's role is going to look like once Bateman does come back. I think they should ease Bateman into action instead of just playing him, you know, 30, 40 snaps if they play that many on offense or whatever. But I just think that they're going to ease Bateman into action. And so you shouldn't expect him to get like 4 or 5 targets his first time out, or, you know, 10 targets or whatever. But I think they might have all those guys active. As far as me, I think Boykin, as much, you know, we'd like to see him return as a run blocker, as far as like the way that this offense is playing right now, as far as leaning more on the pass than the run, just because, you know, their run blocking isn't the best right now, I think they lean more towards having, you know, Prochet, Duvernay, Hollywood, Watkins, and Bateman active, and Miles Boykin inactive.
Boykin.
Yeah.
There's multiple points to this question. So first I want to say is I think they probably like Prochet as a receiver at this point. And so they're not trying to get him out of the receiver role. In the case of Bateman, which is kind of the second of the point that I want to address, is I would kind of put the over under if he is active at maybe about 15 snaps this game. I don't think it's going to be 45 snaps. I don't think it's even going to be 30 snaps. I think, you know, they'll get him in, and, you know, it could be a trial by fire situation if somebody got hurt. So if Sammy Watkins got hurt and Miles Boykin is inactive for some reason, okay, well then Bateman could play a lot of snaps. But it's I wouldn't think that it would happen without some outside influence creating a lot of snaps for him. Otherwise, I think, you know, he's at probably 15 snaps. I also think there's a reasonable chance they might get them all active, all the wide receivers, because they all provide special teams value, and they haven't really had a lot of that from their running backs this year. It's they really need to get as many receivers as possible, because none of those running backs are special teams players, or they're not good special teams players anyway.
Yeah, no. It's just, when you have a bunch of veteran running backs, and none of them are going to provide much value on special teams, which is also kind of frustrating to me about, you know, the way they're doing what they're doing to Tyson, because, like, you know, he actually does play special teams, and you know, I'd like him to be active for more games.
All right. Here's another one from Josh Hoffman. He says, is it my imagination or does Lamar Jackson have about a 90% target rate the last 2 weeks when he has decent pass protection? Well, I mentioned he was 7 of 10 for 146. Maybe not quite what you're thinking about in terms of the percentage completion, but probably 100% of what you're thinking about in terms of the yards per target. So, yes, he's been very effective in those situations.
Oh yeah, Lamar's definitely balling out. Just throwing the ball. I just like the way he's kind of rewriting a lot of his the negative narratives on him coming into this season. As far as, oh, you know, they can't throw their way back into a game, he's done that. Oh, they can't play from behind, he's done that. You know, oh, he can't throw outside of numbers, he's done that. He's done all three of those things in space. The guy's led 3 game winning drives. You know, in the first 4 games, he did it week 1. Just the defense couldn't hold up. You know, so this is a guy who's, like I said, kind of turning, flip, you know, rewriting the script, whatever, you know, you want to use flipping the script, rewriting narratives. But the way he's airing the ball out this year is something spectacular.
Yeah, very, very. I think it's getting much harder for the anti-Lamar people to move the spot. But the one thing that's going to make him easy is if he somehow gets hurt, they're going to say, "I told you so, told you so, told you so." You know, we'll hear.
But
that.
If he gets hurt, it's, well, I feel like this general soreness that he's been experiencing is more from those, you know, from those hits that he's taking after the ball's gone, or those overly aggressive hits he's taking from defenders, more so than it is him flipping into the end zone or anything like that, or him like you're trying to run somebody over, because he's real strategic about which hits he decides to take on and which one he decides to avoid. I mean, I said that flipping into the end zone thing. Okay, shouldn't have done that. But I think a lot of this stuff, the soreness he's feeling, is from those hits that should have been called roughing the passer.
Yep, I would agree with that. Okay, John, I think this may be big booty, but John says, feel like many OL issues could be helped if they would just roll Lamar out more instead of keeping him in the pocket and forcing him to run for his life all the time. Their bootlegs do well, and goal line, not sure why they ever try it outside this area. Okay. So Lamar, of course, has that incredible record of never throwing a red zone interception. And a lot of that is left to right movement to find red zone targets in the end zone without having to loft the ball up high on plays like zipper or a fade route. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with the notion that Lamar is very deadly rolling to his right when he has time. And yeah, they could try more bootlegs with him. One of the issues with bootlegs is, though, if you run it naked, like most teams do, they zone block to the left, they naked boot back to the right. When you run it like that, that edge defender, because it's Lamar Jackson, that's always his number one A priority and has basically 100% of his attention. If it's Joe Flacco, his concern is that running back going to cut back on me? So yeah. You have a better chance for it to work if you have a less mobile quarterback.
Yeah, and that's why people get so up in arms. Man, why don't, like, I see Baker Mayfield having, if you put Lamar Jackson in offense, I'm like, well, if you put Lamar Jackson in offense, they're going to come screaming up the field every time because they're not going to allow him the chance to, you know, turn the corner and need to turn up field or have, read at first, second, and third level. They're going to come screaming up the field and try to blow his butt up, you know? So like when they say like, oh, you know, if the Ravens can run like a Kevin Stefanski-esque or a Sean McVay-esque offense, that's because, like, you know, they have semi-mobile quarterbacks, not dynamic dual-threat quarterbacks like Ravens have. So it's a different level of threat that the signal caller presents that you got to account for.
Yeah, that's a real good way to put it. That's an excellent way to put it, Josh.
I got one.
Okay, that's
going
to do it for tonight.
Sure. I got one. There's a guy that we said we'd get to. Jason Michael Cox, he has, is it a concern that either Cleveland or Powers can't win the left guard spot? And please sign Bozeman. That's a big worry. So as far as the Cleveland and Powers thing, like we mentioned earlier in this game, I think they're taking the slow approach with Ben Cleveland just because, like, he didn't have much of a preseason, only played in one preseason game. He sat out a lot of training camp, you know, with the concussion, and I think he had something else wrong with him. But so I think the first 3 weeks, you know, he's inactive week one. That's when Tyree Phillips went down. And then these last 3 weeks really kind of served as an extension of the preseason for him, at least in my opinion. And I think they're taking the Orlando Brown Jr. approach with him as far as kind of easing him into the lineup before. I'm not saying that Ben Powers is going to be relegated to the bench entirely, but I think that, you know, the more that Cleveland gets acclimated, the more we're going to see of him and less of a rotation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that you know, they have that. The other thing I think they still need to consider with Cleveland is, given the current state of the offensive line and the complete dearth of tackles, if you're going to use your tackle like a guard a lot of the time anyway, which means McCary, they completely cover up on the right side, for example. Whoever you've got on the left side currently, you have to cover him up a lot. Okay, you have to give him help from a back, from a tight end, from six offensive linemen, whatever it might be. I think you got to think about the possibility of moving Ben Cleveland to tackle again. I think it's got to be on the table. And there are a bunch of other options that can fail. They've got some very long arm tackles now on the practice squad that they could give a chance. But I don't think Andre Smith is the answer. And I think, you know, if you have 2 weeks to get Ben Cleveland acclimated to playing right tackle, maybe you take that chance. And you know, he will provide you a lot of what Orlando Brown did initially, in terms of a guy you necessarily don't have to block the edge defender. You leave the edge defender unblocked with air. You run your pistol read option offense again, and you get him to level two, and he will make you some devastating blocks there. The half level up, he'll easily be able to seal that edge, even getting into space. I think he's better athletically than anybody really gives him credit for. So I would still love to see Ben Cleveland get that opportunity at some point. particularly if they're just going to alternate him with Powers at left guard, where they're wasting, I think, two of their decent offensive line options in total on this rotational scheme.
Yeah, definitely, Dick, we brought up a great point as far as the way they like to kind of hide their tackles and pretty much use them as guards. If you're going to keep using those overloaded side of, you know, the offensive line to one side or the other, why not do it? I mean, like I said, it gives you the, you know, the body advantage, and you have a guy who's more equipped to play a position than an Andre Smith, who's way past his prime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Josh, always a pleasure to talk football with you, my friend. I love these conversations. I'm sorry about some of the technical difficulties and the back and forth and the interruptions that occur. We get this on cell phones sometimes, too. It just annoys the heck out of me when it happens. But great things to say. We really appreciate you being on here. Tell folks again where they can find your work.
You can find all my work at BaltimoreBeatdown.com and Anchorage Daily News. You know, if you feel like reading some local Alaska sports content, I'm out there, too.
That's pretty cool. You sent me a link to one of those articles. I'd love to read it, Josh. You cover high school sports there, Ben?
Yeah, so I mostly cover high school sports. I've done some collegiate sports, too, but COVID really kind of put a damper on things. So I mostly do football, basketball, some wrestling. I've done some volleyball. Except when they came up here for the Armed Forces Classic in 2019, I got to cover that. I got to meet Jay Billis. That was pretty cool. You know, I've had some pretty unique opportunities working for ADN. I got to meet Mark Schlereth a couple weekends back. It's a pretty cool, pretty sweet gig.
That's really neat. And I want to see you wearing your state championship ring proudly the next time you're on, which I think is later this season. So we'll talk about that a little later. Other folks, I want to remind people, we're doing the 25 years podcast right now. Please get me an idea for that if you want to. It's your opportunity to be on the air for about 20 minutes and really talk about something you're passionate about from Ravens history. Could be an individual game, an individual player that was your favorite that's kind of forgotten. If you want to talk about Corey Ivey, that's fine. If you want to make a case for why Jared Gaither is better than people remember him, I pretty much agree with you, and I'd love to talk to you about that. If you want to talk about any other game, any other trend in Ravens history, compare a current player to an old player, any of this, that's what this 25 years series is about. It's your opportunity to opine about Ravens history. It's been a wonderful 25 years. It's something we really ought to revel in. I want to get to as many people as we can before the end of the season. So thanks, everybody, for listening tonight. Josh, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.